As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. If you've been following the news at all for the past 4 years, the anger on display in Washington, D.C. last Wednesday might be shocking, but it was not entirely surprising. Traditional news media have been sharing stories of and debunking conspiracy theories that most of us considered obviously false. But in certain corners of certain social media platforms, conspiracy theories flourished and falsehoods gained purchase. To what extent are media companies of all kinds responsible for the current climate? That's the question we're going to dive into today, and we'd love your insights as well. Give us a call now. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or tweet at us at @NHPRExchange. And we've got some knowledgeable people to help us unpack that question right now. Brendan Nyhan, he's a professor of government at Dartmouth College and a contributor to the New York Times newsletter, The Upshot. Brendan, thank you for being on the program today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Annalise Orlick, she's a professor of history at Dartmouth College. Annalise, thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we'll start with you, Annalise. What was your initial reaction as you watched the attempted coup take place on January 6th?
I think that the primary reaction that I had was a sense of shock, not at it happening, because Trump had been calling for it for quite some time. However, the ease with which everyone was able to get into the Capitol, the fact that they had professional tools, the videos of Capitol Police opening gates, some Capitol Police, while others fought very, very hard to protect the Capitol. All of it was, I think, the shocking part, and the realization that there was some kind of actual coup undertaken. You know, so too the news from the Capitol Police head and from others in the Capitol that they had requested National Guard support and had their requests denied. So I think that was the aspect of this that I found most shocking.
And what about you, Brendan? What was your reaction to what happened on Wednesday?
Well, I was shocked and appalled. I will admit far more surprise than Annalise. I mean, I've feared the worst and warned about the potential for the worst since Trump became a national candidate. But to actually see some of those fears come to fruition was another matter entirely. And we should be shocked. I guess I'm stunned at how many parts of our political system are trying to move on and move forward when a violent insurrection took over the U.S. Capitol. In an action that the only precedent is the British sacking of Washington during the War of 1812. These are dramatic events. This was a attack on the symbolic center of our democracy during the counting of the ballots in a presidential election. It does not get more symbolically meaningful than that. And it was a kind of culmination of the process of democratic erosion that we've seen during the Trump years. And a reminder that political violence can very quickly get out of control if extremists are encouraged and inflamed.
Listeners, we're going to be talking about the media's role in what happened on Wednesday, and we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And Brendan, what context do you feel is missing from the discussions that we've been hearing on at least traditional media since last Wednesday? Do you think that there's something that we really need to say out loud that we have not yet?
Well, there's different ways you can put these events in context. One is to put them in context of the last 4 years, which is hard to get our minds around. So much has happened, and things that happened just a few years ago seem like ancient history because of the speed of the news cycle during this presidency. But it's important to keep in mind where we started from and how outlandish even the idea that a contemporary presidential candidate would refuse to accept the results of an election would have been, or would have seemed, as recently as 2015. So just the idea of the president refusing to accept the results of the election, much less campaigning against their acceptance, much less trying to overturn those results, much less encouraging a mob to march on the Capitol and then have that mob move to violence. These were unimaginable acts. So I think it's very important to just keep reminding people how abhorrent and unusual these events were. I talk to my kids about this, about how abnormal this is, because this is their experience, their formative experiences with politics. And we have to keep reminding people that this is unacceptable and abnormal, lest it become normalized. So that's one piece of context. And I think the other, my colleagues who study the history of race in this country have talked about the history of racialized political violence and the impunity with which it's often been carried out in the past, and they've tried to put these events into that context as well. And those parallels were striking when we saw so many people walking out of the Capitol unmolested by police, in some cases aided by them. Now, there's since been an effort to apprehend, arrest, and charge many of the people involved. But it's going to be critical to continue that effort so that there isn't a perception of impunity here that encourages further actions like this, either at the federal level or also in state capitals, where law enforcement is also very worried about similar kinds of events.
Brendan, I want to seize on that word normalize for a moment. I actually want to ask Annalise about that, because for 4 years, when President Trump took office, immediately there were claims after each sort of norm-breaking thing that he did to not normalize this behavior. Traditional news outlets reported on it. Annalise, was there anything more that traditional news outlets could have done to, make it seem, put all these things in context so that they may not have been so shocking, or that they remain shocking as they should be? What do you think?
Well, I think that historical context is really essential here. Some Black commentators that I've read have called this mob act a white lash. And it's incumbent upon us, I think, to look back on the period right after the Civil War, Reconstruction, when elites in the South, those who had been known as the slave power, used political violence very strategically to repress the Black vote and to keep Black candidates from running for office. And more frighteningly, and perhaps closer to what we saw on Wednesday, actually overturning, using mob violence to overturn Black governments in New Orleans in 1866, throughout the 1867-68 campaign, which was one of the reasons, and really perhaps the biggest one, why federal troops were sent south for military reconstruction. They occupied the South for 9 years. And then in 1868, a mob attack in Wilmington, North Carolina, literally on the state capitol, overturned the legislature there, forced out Black elected officials. So on the one hand, I think it's very important for the media not to normalize this. And there's no question that, they have treated Trump as if he was the same as other politicians. But I think historical context is also important. White supremacist ideas in the leadership of our federal government, that's not a new phenomenon. In 1924, 25, when the Klan was at its height of popularity nationally, it was estimated they had very powerful ties to 11 governors, 75 members of Congress, many senators. And I think that the media really needs to remind us all that the presence of Confederate flags in that mob was not an accident. Mm-hmm. And that Trump's vetoing of the defense appropriations bill, in part because it included plans to change the names of military bases, so they no longer honored Confederate military officers. All of it was a call back to this vision of the Confederacy. That's when America was great again, right? When America was white again. And I really think that we have to talk about that. The other big issue that I thought I really would like to focus on in terms of how the military has, how the media covered this mob action, and how it has covered Trump voters for 4 years, 5 years, is this myth-making about his supporters being largely white working class. That has never been true. In the 2016 election, the average income of his voters was over $75,000 a year. And if you look at the arrest record and we start to see who's being arrested in the Capitol assault, we have lawyers, CEOs, one woman flew on a private jet. We have retired military officers, real estate brokers, business people of all kinds. So I really think the media has to both give more deeper historical context on the history of race in this country and racial violence, as Brendan has talked about, the history of political violence, and also stop, you know, perpetuating this myth that all of this is about, you know, the understandable anguish and loss of status of the white working class, because that really is not to a great degree what is going on here.
Point taken, Annalisa. I really appreciate your thoughts on that. And I wanted to ask you about the idea of white supremacy in government not being a new thing. What is new about it now with respect to the media, both traditional media and social media? Are these two things enabling those people to connect and amplify their voices in ways that they previously were not?
Well, social media does that. It you know, it has democratized organizing all across the political spectrum, but it has also made it really difficult to tell truth from fiction. And Hannah Arendt in The Origins of Totalitarianism at the very beginning says one of the first steps that's necessary to establish authoritarian rule, totalitarian rule, is creating an environment where it becomes increasingly difficult to separate fact from fiction, to the point of disorientation, to the point where people look toward the dear leader as the only one who can tell them the truth. And I absolutely think that social media has played a role in getting our culture to the point where many of Trump's supporters do look at him in that way.
Well, can I ask you about the difficulty factor that you mentioned there? Because I don't know if it's hard for people to actually find out what's truth and what's not. I mean, if you see something weird on social media, I don't know if most of us would, but a lot of us would try and find a second source for that and say, hey, is this true or is this nonsense? The fact that people aren't doing that doesn't make the articles that they see that have conspiracy theories seem any more valid. It just means they haven't done their homework, right?
Well, but I think the way people get their news has really changed. I was talking to my kids and my students about where they get their news. And, you know, they thought it was admirable that I read the Washington Post and the Guardian every morning, but they can't imagine doing that. They don't believe in anything reported on television, even in mainstream media. You know, they might see something they don't like on social media. And then my son said, I'll go talk to my friends. They're educated, they're intelligent, and we discuss what we think is going on. So I think when people see, we have a lot of echo chamber problems here in the United States, in the sense that people don't tend to live in communities with those who disagree with them. The red and blue parts of the country are so divided that we don't often get to know people who really have very different political views. So, you know, where would you get your facts checked, you know, except in, you know, I think mainstream newspapers are still respected, but there are fewer and fewer of them.
We've got this note from John in Webster, who says the word insurrection has been used by the media often since the riots last week. By definition, wasn't the taking of the police station and the courthouse during last summer's riots also insurrections? I don't recall that word used by the media describing those actions at any time over the extended time frame. What's different? Brendan Nyhan, what do you make of John's comment? The use of the word insurrection to describe this particular riot, but not those that occurred last summer.
Well, I think the distinction, you know, I can't speak for the media, obviously, but I think the distinction that we should make is between, you know, protests against state violence, which is what we saw in the cases of, you know, demonstrations, particularly over the summer against police violence, which in some cases did turn violent or ended up with some incidents or looting or things like that. I don't mean to minimize that, but I think that's different than taking over the literal capital of the United States and trying to overturn the results of an election. If that's not insurrection, I don't know what is. And, you know, I guess I don't think also we should try to avoid getting caught in semantic cul-de-sacs where we're simply arguing about words. I would also encourage people to avoid what's often called whataboutism, which is when something bad happens that's disadvantageous to your side, to say, well, what about that other thing? Isn't that just as bad? You know, people may have their objections to the cases where there were violence during the police protests, although I would note that the statistics actually show that those were very rare. But regardless, that doesn't make what happened on January 6th any more acceptable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make it any more legitimate.
Well, let me ask, can I ask you about the words that we use?
It's still insurrection.
Well, let me ask you about the words that we use, because you're on one side, yes, it might be too much of a semantic argument to make, you know, we'd be splitting hairs. On the other hand, there people are calling to call this what it is. Now, media organizations that have made a commitment to be nonpartisan are very careful about what they call it, but are the words that we use to describe this not important?
Oh, certainly. I guess I would say you were asking how well the media had done. And I would actually say that the media was quite aggressive about labeling what we saw as what it was, which was a violent insurrection. There were people in the media very quickly moved from describing those who took part in the storming of the Capitol. They stopped using the language of protesters, which is inappropriate in the case of something like this. And they started using insurrection, violence, mob, words like that. And those are words, as you point out, the media is quite careful about using. They're very loaded terms. And that's why I think it was symbolically powerful that the media did label what we saw in such a stark way. They conveyed the gravity and magnitude of what happened at the Capitol. And I think that's appropriate. I guess my concern is, after the fact, we should keep our focus on the first order concern, which is a violent insurrection that overran the capital of the United States, not a second order concern about language that could divert us and cause us to lose sight from the importance of what happened. Of course, the way the media covers it matters, but I think we should really focus on the threat to our democracy more so than the exact language we use to describe it.
I got this note from Mike in Warner, who, in his note to me, went on at length to accuse NHPR of giving Antifa a pass while criticizing pro-Trump extremists. An excerpt of this I'll read. Mike writes, "When you fail to consistently denounce violence on all sides, you only encourage its spread. If you tolerate the violence inflicted to some, then some will tolerate the violence inflicted to you." That is the note from Mike and Warner. I brought it in to make sure that we can be clear that on this program, nobody has encouraged or supported violence. Nobody. Violence is not a thing that NHPR supports. But we wanted to bring that comment in, and in the context of the conversation that we're having today about what happened on Wednesday. And I wanted to ask you, Annalise, a question about what some of those pro-Trump extremists were wearing and how the media has talked about it since then. We saw one man wearing a Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt, someone wearing a shirt that says 6WME, which stands for 6 million wasn't enough. These ideas have lived in the shadows for a long time, and now we're talking about them on public radio. I mean, is this a bad sign, Annalise?
Well, before I answer that, and I will, I wanted to respond a little bit to the first question. The taking over of the police station in Minneapolis, interestingly, in the aftermath, evidence came out that there were actually right-wing provocateurs who were involved in that takeover. So some of the violence, not all of it by any means, that we have seen in the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, and there was relatively little violence, really. But some of what we saw was provocateurs, and we have evidence for that. That's fact. That's not simply
provocateurs, meaning people who weren't protesting in good faith, but they meant to cause trouble that would maybe reflect badly on the protesters. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and we saw that in many parts of the country. There's evidence of it in Brooklyn, New York. There's evidence of it in Minneapolis. It was an attempt to make the protesters look bad, and that's actually received, to my mind, not enough coverage. Secondly, as far as that question, the second question that you sent in, I want to comment and build on the work of my former colleague, Mark Bray, who's a historian of anti-fascism, and who has reminded us there's no such organization as Antifa. There are, you know, there are people who organize against fascist groups across the country. All statistics from the Anti-Defamation League, from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who cover hate crimes in the United States, show that very clearly there's many, many times the amount of violence by right-wing and white supremacist protesters than there has been on the left, where there's been almost none. And, you know, it's so, you know, in terms of media coverage, I think it's really important, and Mark really tried to point that out, to not talk about Antifa as if it's an organization. It's not, right? It is a set of beliefs by very, very different people across the country who consider themselves committed to fighting what they see as fascist encroachment in their communities. Okay, now let's get to the violent genocidal statements that we saw in the clothing of people who stormed
sure.
the Capitol. Okay, I want to make clear who these people were. I was watching the news, and the director of the Anti-Defamation League, Stephen Greenblatt, was looking at footage, and he was naming people. He said, okay, those are the Oath Keepers, those are the, you know, the Proud Boys, those are the 3%, right? Those are all of these white supremacist groups that he was aware of. He knew the names of the leaders whose faces he could see in the Capitol. So this was an assault by known white supremacist Nazi supporting groups who wear Camp Auschwitz staff and, you know, six MWE gear, right, which all of them have bought, you know, calling for further genocidal action against Jews. Now, what is the difference here as opposed to, let's say, the worst domestic terrorist assault in the United States, the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City 26 years ago? That was a horrific act of violence, and perhaps by infiltrating the militias that perpetrated that, the federal government should have been able to stop it from happening. And according to the FBI, they did stop 9 white supremacists heading to Washington, D.C. last Wednesday to, you know, to enact real carnage. So they follow these people. They know what they're doing. Difference is, the president of the United States called on people to do this. The president said, I'll walk with you to the Capitol. His son said, we need to let people know that we're coming after you and we're going to have fun doing it. Mm-hmm. Giuliani called for trial by combat. I mean, these people, the difference is they were not laboring in the shadows once Trump was in office. The president of the United States and his administration called on them to do this. And when people, security officials in Congress and Congress people called for the National Guard, and the mayor of Washington, D.C., and the head of the Capitol Police called for the National Guard to come in, they were denied. They were denied 6 times, according to the Capitol Police chief who resigned. Mm-hmm. That's a coup attempt. And so what you have is really equivalent to what we saw in Reconstruction, the marshaling of these violent white supremacist mobs by people in power to try to achieve their own ends, overturn an election.
That's Annalise Orlick. She's professor of history at Dartmouth College. We're also speaking with Brendan Nyhan. He's a professor of government at Dartmouth College. We'll have more with both of our guests about the role social media in particular has played in what we saw on Wednesday in D.C. And we'd love to hear from you on this as well. Give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Does social media need to be better regulated? And what would those regulations look like while also maintaining a free exchange of ideas? 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello in for Laura Kanoi today, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for being with us. We're discussing how social media and information campaigns, disinformation campaigns, contributed to the rage that culminated in the attack on the U.S. Capitol last week by pro-Trump extremists. We'd love to get your take on the role social media played. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can tweet us at NHPR Exchange or send us an email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Brendan Nyhan. He's a professor of government at Dartmouth College and a contributor to the New York Times newsletter, The Upshot. And Annalise Orlick, she's a professor of history at Dartmouth College. We're getting a variety of notes from listeners. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Email from Susan. Susan says, before the media demanded transparency, politicians like Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan could have a private lunch, work out a compromise on a contentious issue, and take it back to their constituencies and get a job done. Now, an effort like that is impossible. Media mics are thrust in faces, and oppositions on both sides raise their hackles, and no compromises are reached. That's the note from Susan. And we also got a note from Brian on Facebook, who says, our knowledge of the insurrection and aftermath shows the importance of the Fourth Estate. We appreciate both your comments. Listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on the conversation, our number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. Annalise Orlick, with respect to disinformation, to what extent did disinformation on social media in particular contribute to Wednesday's attack?
I think it did a lot. You know, every once in a while, I monitor pages with people who have very different views from my own. And I think that social media, you know, Twitter, Trump's medium, you know, which allows him to say things, you know, very, very concisely. It doesn't leave a lot of room for nuance, for black and white. Everything is black and white, rather than shades of gray. And I think that and social media, you know, if you're on the air, if you're in a newspaper, you have fact checkers. If you're on the air in a mainstream news station, and even Fox News has started to push back against out and out telling of lies. But, you know, we have, you know, in social media, you can't, you know, you lies are not answered, right? And people really believe. We have mutually contradictory truths. You know, it's not new. I mean, you know, in George Bush's administration, there was discussion of, you know, the fact-based, reality-based community, the fact-based community. You know, early on in this administration, under Lyndon Johnson, there were many, many lies told from the White House about how the Vietnam War was going. So it's not possible to tell lies only on social media, but it makes it a lot easier.
Okay. Let's go to the phones and talk to, I believe it's David from Munsonville. David, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome. I just found it interesting that the professor just cited, you know, what I think you as the moderator should have picked her up on, is citing that, well, we know that there were right-wing provocateurs involved in this summer riot and that summer act, you know, demonstration. You know, that's exactly the kind of thing that happens on the other side all the time. Oh, we know that there was, you know, Antifa people that were really, you know, part of upsetting the Capitol. That's exactly the kind of thing that we all got to watch out for. And I'm stunned that a professor would make that kind of a comment without citing a police report or something.
Well, let's give her a chance to cite.
And that you wouldn't have asked her for that.
Point taken. Thanks, David. So what do you think, Annalise?
Look at the reports by the Minneapolis police chief and by the Attorney General of Minnesota, which provided some evidence that there were actually right-wing provocateurs involved in the burning of the police station during the George Floyd protests.
Thank you very much.
Someone was charged in federal, a U.S. attorney filed charges against a self-described member of the Boogaloo Boys. You can look this up. There's a release from the Department of Justice on October 23rd. This is Donald Trump's Department of Justice.
Okay. Well, hopefully that will inspire some trust in David, and thank you very much. The question from sitting from my chair, I have to kind of decide on the fly when to ask for receipts and when not to, and when doing so would actually provide some level of trust among those who are listening. Brendan, what do you think? I mean, we see this a lot from folks on social media. Sometimes they're genuine in asking to say, where did you learn that? And sometimes they do it simply to provoke. So what can you say about the trustworthiness of such requests?
Well, I want to presume the good faith of the audience. I appreciate everyone who's listening and taking part in our politics. It is true that we have to be careful about the endless regress of demand for more and more evidence and more proof that we often see. There's a kind of characteristic pattern that we see among conspiracy theorists where they constantly say there's more and more proof. They keep shifting the goalposts, right? They're constantly demanding more and more evidence. This is actually what we saw after the election as it was affirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed that Joe Biden legitimately won, and people continued to try to raise questions or claim that the evidence that had been provided and verified and re-verified was somehow flawed or more questions had to be answered, right? So I think that's the balance we have to strike, is we have to address people's concerns in good faith, but at the same time realize that there are people who are raising concerns in bad faith, and they're often pursuing strategic objectives politically. And I don't mean folks in the audience here, I mean political elites who cultivate doubt strategically. Like, so we've seen this pattern in the time since the election. Republican elites, including most prominently, of course, the president of the United States, question the integrity of the election. Members of the public, particularly Republican identifiers, people who identify as Republicans, then express concern in polls about the integrity of the election. And those same Republicans would say, look, there are these concerns among the public that we have to address. And they would use that to fuel demands for more investigations, more recounts, and so forth, right? And that kind of self-perpetuating cycle, I think, was undertaken in bad faith by many people. So I do want to presume the good faith of folks here. And of course, it is complicated and it's hard to follow. And there is a lot of misinformation out there. So I understand why people might raise questions.
And David's question certainly was appropriate and worth asking.
Yeah, yeah. So absolutely. So. But I guess what I would just say is we have to make that distinction between, you know, our society requires some level of trust in the knowledge producing institutions of society, the media, the law enforcement apparatus, all the scientific community. And one of the things we've struggled with as a society is how to function when trust in a lot of those institutions is so low.
Mm-hmm. We get this note from Jerry, I think is the way it's pronounced. What do you think about a federal committee that decides what is disinformation? It could be made up of Democrats, Republicans, and independents. If by a 2/3 vote they decide a major topic in the news is misinformation, it would need to be taken down. This would take it out of the hands of Twitter, Facebook, Fox News, and others. Annalise, what do you think about Jerry's suggestion there?
I mean, on the one hand, it seems like a good idea. On the other hand, it's a little dangerous. It feels a little bit like a slippery slope. And I think that's the quandary we face, because there is so much disinformation. It is so dangerous. And people, I think feel that there should be some limits. At the same time, to have the government regulate speech in that way is concerning. However, government, you know, does have a role to play. I mean, where I'm not a free speech purist and where I think we really might need to start looking at speech are threats of violence and implied threats of violence. And I think everything from, you know, the shirts that you described that people were wearing at the protest were an implied threat of violence, to the second, the goodwill of all the questioners in your audience, I don't question, but the person who had an implicit threat about how if you support violence against other people, then we support it against you. That kind of language, I think, has been ratcheted up during the Trump years, and I think it's dangerous, and I do think we need to have some regulation of it.
Brendan, what do you think?
I don't think such a commission is a good idea, and I want to be really specific about why. I mean, in a pure legal sense, it would require amending the Constitution. It would violate the First Amendment. In a practical sense, I would just ask people to think about whether they actually want political control over the fact claims that can be made in our politics. Misinformation is a challenge for us as a society right now. It's become more partisan, and it moves faster on social media than it has in recent history. But that doesn't mean we should give up on free speech and the First Amendment. Certainly, political violence is a different matter entirely, as Annalise suggested. And I think First Amendment jurisprudence acknowledges that distinction. I don't think we should leap, though, from fears about misinformation to aggressive policing of speech in a way that would undermine the protections that we legitimately have. Think about the politicians you don't like regulating your speech and how much you think that would be a good idea, or even if such a commission could be, how it would function. Something like the Federal Election Commission, for instance, which decides on violations of campaign laws and rules, is made up with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. It essentially can't agree on anything and can't function. So these kinds of institutions are very difficult to create, even if one thought it was a good idea in practical terms. And I think even in a philosophical sense, I just don't think the government should be adjudicating truth in that way outside the narrow set of exceptions that we currently recognize.
Want to ask about Twitter recently banning President Trump for life, and Facebook banning him at least through the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden on January 20th. Annalise, what do you make of this? Because in some ways, this lends ammunition to the argument that the political right is making, that big tech just doesn't like Republicans. And this is a debatable point, of course, but nevertheless, it's fodder for the right's talking point. What is your take on this?
I just think it's interesting that a lot of politicians who have the view that business should essentially, business is a person, right, as defined under Citizens United, and have the rights, all the rights to, you know, donate unlimited amounts to campaigns and, you know, complete freedom of action, are now assaulting free speech by taking Trump off the air. I think also, you know, in terms of this notion of big tech not liking Republicans, the role of Facebook in spreading this information paid for by people who wanted to support Trump's election in 2016 has just begun to be documented, but it's pretty clear. And, I think up until this insurrection, there hasn't been a whole lot of regulation. There's some regulation of political ads, during the last campaign and through the end of the Georgia campaign. But, you know, Twitter, this was it yesterday or this morning, just got rid of 70,000 accounts with ties to QAnon conspiracy theories. So it's really only now that they're beginning to regulate the spread of conspiracy theories that could potentially lead to violence.
And is that a good thing in your view, that they're eliminating these accounts?
You know, in the end, probably yes. There has to be limits. You know, you can't say fire. I mean, I worry about free speech, but you can't say fire in a crowded theater, right? That was Oliver Wendell Holmes's notion of where your free speech rights ended. And I think that social media has become a crowded theater, and we saw fires set in the Capitol the other day. And remember, all the folks who were involved in that are promising more. They're promising more violence, armed protests, storming capitals between January 16th and January 20th in every state capital in the country, as well as Washington, D.C. So this crisis is not over, and this coup attempt is not over.
And Brendan Nyhan, has our approach to social media or disinformation changed since President Trump's election?
Oh, absolutely. Facebook and the other social media companies were caught quite off guard in 2016 by, you know, in that case, the rise of untrustworthy websites. And since then, Facebook in particular has stood up an elaborate content moderation apparatus. Twitter has been more hands-off until recently, but has started doing things like labeling President Trump's tweets or even hiding them or removing them. So we've seen a much more aggressive approach taken. I think it's a really delicate balance to strike. I don't think it's a First Amendment question because, again, these platforms are not part of the government. It's not strictly governmental regulation of free speech. At the same time, these sites and platforms are becoming a kind of set of critical public forums for participating in public life. So these platforms now make these choices that regulate access to essentially the public square for tens or hundreds of millions of people. That's concentrating a lot of power over political speech in the hands of a few tech company executives. So I think some of the steps that have been taken are appropriate. Taking down the QAnon accounts, given the violence associated with that movement, is, I think, appropriate. But we should be worried about the power we're giving to those companies and the leverage they will now be able to exert over people up to and including the president of the United States under any administration. I think that's something we need to grapple with as a society going forward.
Give us a call if you'd like to join this conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's talk to Jake in Plymouth. Jake, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Sure. Thanks so much for taking my call, and I appreciate the program. I just sort of wanted to ask for some help in unpacking a sort of frustration I am experiencing with how we talk about misinformation and disinformation. It seems to me that the sort of both the acute and the chronic danger of disinformation is that it's disinformation coming specifically from the political right for the purposes of actual violence, for the purposes of destabilizing our government and our country, and that disinformation is specifically enabled by members of the Republican Party at large. And so I think when I sort of hear the terms, the general terms, disinformation and misinformation, I'm sort of internally always connecting it to that in my head. And so it's sometimes frustrating not to hear it explicitly named and in that language. So I just wanted to ask, like, A, sort of, is that the right way to be thinking about this? And B, if it is, why not sort of always discuss it in those terms? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jake. Appreciate your call. Annalise, would you like to take a stab at answering that?
I mean, you know, the conventional answer, which I agree with, is that, you know, the answer to speech is more speech. And so I think the media, since this is the theme of this show, we can come back to that, have a responsibility to call out disinformation and lies, you know, where they see it. That's a standard journalistic practice to have, you know, have fact checking. So I think that's one thing. But I think that the caller is making a really important point as regards political violence, because the use of disinformation is part of it, has been part of a concerted campaign to dehumanize various segments of our population, including the millions of protesters who went out into the street over the summer to protest state violence against civilians. And I think that the purpose of that disinformation and that dehumanization is to make it okay to harm people, to limit speech. And, you know, we're seeing that play out, for example, in laws coming out of state legislatures that have been Republican controlled across the country that make it okay to physically attack, for people to physically attack protesters, to hit them with their cars if they block the street. So I think that disinformation and dehumanization have worked in tandem, and that it is the responsibility of all of us, but certainly legitimate media and responsible media, to unpack lies when they're hearing them from, even from elected officials, especially from elected officials.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the partisan nature of media institutions and other elements that might have a partisan flavor to them. Our guests are Annalise Orlik, professor of history at Dartmouth College, and Brendan Nyhan. He's professor of government at Dartmouth College. We'd also love for you to join this conversation. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or tweet us at @NHPRExchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you for being with us today. We're discussing how social media and disinformation campaigns contributed to the rage that culminated in an attack on the U.S. Capitol last week by pro-Trump extremists. Call us now if you've got a question or comment about the media's role in all this. Use Facebook or tweet us at @NHPRExchange or email us exchange@NHPR.org. Brendan Nyhan and Annalise Orlik of Dartmouth College are with us in this hour. And I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you know the answer to this, Brendan, but to what extent is the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987 responsible, at least in part, for this? That law required some broadcasters to represent a variety of news, a variety of opinions on controversial topics, and some argue it led to the partisan nature of our media ecosystem today, allowed far-right talk stations to emerge. To what extent is the loss of the Fairness Doctrine part of this conversation?
You know, it's a complicated question. It applies specifically to broadcast licenses, so I don't think it would extend to the full, panoply of outlets and communications media that people now worry about as promoting slanted information. The fairness doctrine would impose some burden on broadcast television and, for instance, AM talk radio, as you mentioned.
Did
FM as well, but obviously AM talk radio is what took off. So the repeal of that, right, did help open the door to something like the conservative talk radio boom in the 1980s and 1990s, leading to Rush Limbaugh and people like that. It reduced the pressure to have, even-handed broadcast news, although the commercial imperatives to have relatively even-handed broadcast television news, remained. So I guess I think people are most worried about now, today, cable television, channels like Fox, and the internet. And those are all outside the scope of something like the Fairness Doctrine. And I'm not really sure how we would enforce something like that in practice today. I think it would run into a lot of the same challenges that we talked about in terms of, what is the appropriate, let's just take the example we're talking about now. What is the appropriate way to cover a violent insurrection in the U.S. Capitol, right? Mm-hmm. Could someone say we are not being even-handed on giving both sides of the violent takeover of the seat of our government, right? I mean, these are very difficult and complicated questions. It is true that, we've gone to a more laissez-faire approach to media regulation and free speech jurisprudence. That's the broad tendency in our politics. It's not without costs and it's not without flaws. But again, I would just caution people to think that there's a simple regulatory or legal solution here. I don't think there is.
We get this note from Josh in Portsmouth, who writes, Congress needs to pass legislation allowing social media companies to be held accountable for the disinformation they make money off spreading. Annalise Orlik, what do you think? Brendan was saying that it's kind of difficult to do, but is there a role for Congress in maybe punishing social media companies that allow this kind of speech on their platforms?
I'm concerned about free speech and government regulation of it. However, because there's a profit motive and because we're talking about, again, actual hate speech that incites violence and sometimes that calls for violence, I'm willing to see a discussion. I think a hearing would be appropriate. I think a discussion of what could be done would be appropriate. I strongly agree with Brendan. There's no easy answer. And I think, this is a discussion we're going to be having for a while, but it is absolutely worth having.
Yeah. We get this note from Lori, who says, Dr. Orlik just said state laws are legalizing violence against protesters where you can hit protesters with your car and it's legal. Please explain and be more specific. Dr. Orlik, does that accurately represent what you'd said?
Pretty much. I mean, there were attempts to pass laws in Florida, in, I believe, South Dakota after the Standing Rock protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and laws actually saying you can hit a protester with your car and not be criminally indicted have been up for discussion in a number of Republican-controlled legislatures. So yes, hard to believe as that is an actual political phenomenon happening these days.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned they were Republican-controlled, and our caller before the break mentioned that there is a partisan nature to the disinformation being spread. Seemed like the caller wanted to have a firm Republican label attached to most of the disinformation. Is that fair?
I think one of the after effects of all of us being immersed in social media is that probably everybody spreads things, everybody retweets, everybody shares Facebook posts that they haven't fact-checked. So no, I don't think that it is exclusively a Republican problem. I do think, however, that there are segments of the GOP that we have seen, including, Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann and certain members of Congress, Matt Gaetz and others, who tried to pretend that this attack on the Capitol last Wednesday was perpetrated by Antifa dressed as, as Trump supporters. So that is a very particular kind of Republican disinformation spreading, yes.
Listeners, please give us a call if you've got a question or a comment. 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Robert in Epsom. Robert, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. Misinformation has always existed. It always will exist. It's part of human nature. It may be unethical, but it's not illegal. Violence, on the other hand, is illegal. And I think what it might take is an overwhelming show of force up front, you know, maybe from the National Guard, whatever, on these hot spots on hot days to block the violence before the destruction takes place and people end up in the courts and the courts get bogged down. So if it can be blocked in the first place with an overwhelming show of violence, maybe that's what it'll take.
And Robert, we've been speaking a little bit about the point at which speech becomes violence, talking about the old Supreme Court case that said if you shout fire in a crowded theater, that might constitute as such. What do you think? At what point for you does disinformation become dangerous violence that should be regulated?
Well, it's sort of an academic discussion because it's not really going to solve the problem. I think, you know, the violence has to be blocked by force. And, you know, people are going to disagree on where to draw the line. You know, it's a gray, squiggly territory where that line is crossed with free speech. So,
point taken, Robert. Know. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate that. So you can always count on public radio for a good academic discussion, by the way. So thank you very much. So I wanted to ask you both about the news consumption habits of Americans writ large. Brendan Nyhan, how would you describe it?
Well, they're very diverse. I think it's hard to generalize. You know, one thing that behavioral data reveals in a way that survey data doesn't is just how diverse people's level of interest in politics and consumption of political news is. So you might think about people not just as being in echo chambers. You know, we've talked about that problem, but what the behavioral data suggests is the kind of people who are consuming a lot of political news heavily from one side are the exception, not the rule. A lot of people don't follow politics very closely at all. Those who do often have more balanced media diets than you think. They may not agree with everything they're seeing, especially when it comes from a side they don't support, but there's more of a mix than you might think. There is this minority of people, though, who have more slanted information diets, and they're especially visible online and often especially active in our politics. And I think they can create a kind of sense of ubiquity. That's how everyone is. That's how our politics works, even when their experience is relatively unusual. And, you know, in the most extreme versions of that, you can get the kind of people who showed up at the Capitol riot who may be in very you know, dark and dangerous corners of the internet where people are promoting extremism or violence or worse. So I think we really have to be specific in thinking about the problem. It's not the case that everyone is on Reddit message boards all day talking about their violent fantasies. But when politicians are preaching that kind of the kinds of messages like the election is being stolen, 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000 people may be moved not just to outrage, but to action. And what we saw in Washington was an example of what can happen when that gets out of control. And that's why I would just underscore, to return to the point you were asking about earlier, Peter, I would underscore the importance of not focusing on mis or disinformation as the problem itself. The problem is it's being used as a tool of politicians who are trying to mobilize people, in this case, to overturn an election result. The mis and disinformation was a tool that was used. The underlying problem was the political elites who had lost power and were using the tools at hand to try to maintain power. And you know, what we need to do is discourage those elites from promoting those messages in the first place, rather than playing whack-a-mole with every specific false claim they make, which is typically ineffective and unlikely to solve the real problem we're grappling with as a country.
There's too much, it seems, to be able to effectively whack-a-mole them into oblivion. Our time is short. I do want to finish our show today with a question to you, Annalise Orlik, since you're a professor of history. What can we learn from historical events similar to what we saw on Wednesday to help us recover from what we have seen?
Well, I think we can learn that while it was shocking in many ways. It wasn't entirely unprecedented. And in particular, that we are seeing, as Brendan just said very correctly, the mobilization of, you know, white mob violence by elites to try to maintain power, to try to overturn an election. We've seen this, we saw this during Reconstruction. We've seen, you know, white mob outbursts after World War I in Chicago and St. Louis, and after World War II, where you had all these lynchings of Black soldiers still in uniform because people didn't like the idea of, you know, Black soldiers representing the United States and felt like it made them, you know, it made them uppity and made them forget their place. I think we have to really start, we have to look at history and the damage that has been done in the past by these mobilizations of white mobs to commit violence against people of color and Jews and other folks, immigrants, you know, when their rights were expanding. I think we can learn from history that rights are not a zero-sum game, and that any politician who tells you they are, right, that if you expand the base of political rights, that's other people lose theirs. If anyone tells you they are, then they've got an agenda, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to enhance their power. So I think it's very important to put this in historical context. And I think that that we need to move beyond history, though, in recognizing the role. And we couldn't learn that active police, police forces have long been infiltrated by white supremacist groups. The FBI has been doing reports on this for the last decade or so to try to give us, you know, a clear sense of what's going on. Certainly that happened during the civil rights era. We've seen it in the military. All of these historical precedents need to move us to action because...
Well, I might have to leave you there, Annalise Orlik, a professor of history at Dartmouth College. Thank you very much for being on the program today. Thanks also to Brendan Nyhan. He's professor of government at Dartmouth College, contributor to the New York Times newsletter, The Upshot, as well. And that's it for today. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Today's show was produced by Jane Vaughn. Engineer is Dan Colgan. Executive producer, Michael Brindley. Our theme music composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.